Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 24th of March, and une fois n'est pas coutume, we are going to start with the announcements of two bodies, meetings, and I'll start with Pascal. You have an update on the Council, on Human Rights Council. Go ahead, Pascal.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. So yes, I have an update for you regarding the program of work of the ongoing 61st session of the Council. The United Nations Human Rights Council will hold an urgent debate on Wednesday, the 25th of March, to, quote, discuss the recent military aggression launched by Iran against Bahrain, Jordan, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates on the 28th of February, 2026, targeting civilians and civilian infrastructures, which has resulted in the loss of innocent lives, end quote. This urgent debate is being convened following an urgent official request submitted on the 18th of March by Bahrain on behalf of the Cooperation Council for Arab States of the Gulf and Jordan. The request states that the group of countries intends to present a draft resolution to the Council in connection with this urgent debate. This draft resolution was tabled yesterday under the title, quote, Human Rights Implication of the Unprovoked Attack by the Islamic Republic of Iran against Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan, end quote. This urgent debate will start tomorrow at 9 a.m. in the Assembly Hall of the Palais des Nations in Geneva. So consequently, the Council will meet from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. nonstop tomorrow on the 25th of March. And this meeting is open to the media and will be webcast live in the six official languages of the UN. On 23rd of March, yesterday, the President of the Human Rights Council received a letter from the permanent representative of the Islamic Republic of Iran on behalf of his country, the People's Republic of China, and Cuba, requesting the convening of an urgent debate during the ongoing 61st session of the Council. The title of this urgent debate is entitled, quote, Protection of Children and Educational Institutions in International Armed Conflicts, the aerial attack on Shajare Tayabe girls' schools in Minam, Iran, as a grave breach of international humanitarian law and international human rights, end quote. This letter has been circulated to all delegations, and the Council Bureau will discuss this matter this afternoon. The President of the Council told delegation this morning that the holding of two urgent debates in the same session of the Council will have a significant impact on the remainder of the program of work and puts us at risk of not completing our session on time. So the President requested the Undersecretary General for General Assembly and Conference Management to authorize conference services for another second urgent debate. In the meantime, the Council Bureau will discuss the situation and will keep you informed whether when this second urgent debate will take place. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pascal. Let me see if there is any question for you in the room first or online. Sorry, I see there are questions in the chat. But nothing to mention here. So if there are no questions for Pascal, I'll let him go to the Council, and we'll stay also with the announcement with another governing board, which is the one of ILO, and Isabel is here to tell us about it.
Thank you, Alessandra. The 356th session of the International Labour Organization governing body opened yesterday at the ILO headquarters in Geneva, and will run through the 2nd of April, so next week. We already sent you a media advisory with all the information. The session's agenda includes discussion on the ILO's role in a changing multilateral environment with a focus on improving the organization's effectiveness. The governing body will also consider the ILO's development cooperation strategy for 2026-29, which sets out the organization approach to partnerships in support of decent work priorities. In addition, the session will also examine a number of country cases under the ILO's supervisory procedures. All the documents, the full documentation, agenda, and all related material are available on ILO.org. And if you want to attend, you can send us a request at newsroom@ILO.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Isabel. Any question to ILO? in the room or online? Let me see online if there's anybody. I don't see any hands up. So thank you very much for this announcement. And now let's go to our topics. I'd like to start, we'll go to Africa today for a couple of situations. And let's start with the DRC. Babar, thank you for bringing us Ali Mahamat, I hope I pronounce it well, UNHCR head of office in Goma. And he is connecting from Goma. I can see you, sir. I don't know if you want to start, Babar. We start directly with Ali. Okay, so please go ahead, sir, with your introductory remarks, and then we will give the floor to the journalists for the questions, if any. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you so much. So a brief view on Congolese return from Burundi. More than 33,000 Congolese refugees have spontaneously returned from Burundi to Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, within a month, following the reopening of the Burundi-DRC border on 23 February. UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, is calling for urgent international support to ensure that return take place in conditions of safety, dignity, and sustainability. Most return are crossing through the Kamvivira border point near Uvira in South Kivu province. They fled to Burundi in December 2025 when fighting between the armed forces of Democratic Republic of Congo, FRDC, and the M23 armed group forced thousands to flee Uvira and surrounding areas. Following the recent stability in Uvira and the reopening of the border, some refugees expressed a wish to return home. Returns were also accelerated by the severe underfunding for the response in Burundi, which has reduced assistance levels and led many refugees to return home amid continued uncertainty. Around 30% of returnees have been living in Burundi Busuma refugee site, where funding shortfalls mean overcrowding and limited water, sanitation, medicine, and shelter, despite the best efforts of authority, UNHCR and partners. Near 4,500 people remain in transit centers awaiting relocation to Busuma. As of 23 March 2026, Burundi continued to host about 109,000 Congolese refugees, including around 67,000 in Busuma. Conditions in many area of return in DRC remain fragile, with acute humanitarian need. Initial UNHCR assessment in Uvira and Fizi show families arriving with few belongings, in urgent need of shelter, basic household items, health care, and access to water and sanitation. Many returned to find their home destroyed and belonging looted, leaving them in deep despair and unable to resume normal life without substantial support. UNHCR and partner are increasing protection monitoring and urgent humanitarian assistance in close coordination with national and provincial authorities. Teams are deployed at border point and in return area to monitor risk and identify vulnerable individuals. In Uvira and Fizi, we are providing emergency tarpaulins, blankets, soap, and protection services. We are also delivering hot meal to returnees alongside registration and screening in close collaboration with government counterparts. UNHCR reiterates that refugee decisions to return must be respected and all return must remain voluntary, safe and dignified, while recent return movement reflect hope for stability as well as the impact of underfunding. They should not expose family to renewed risks. Strengthening security, basic service, and support for host community in return area is essential. UNHCR's response to the need of refugees, returnees, and internally displaced people in DRC is currently 34% funded, again, total requirement of 145 million. And UNHCR support for Congolese refugees in Burundi is only 20% funded. Additional funding is urgently needed to support the life-saving need of this family, both those who have returned and those who remain displaced. Thank you.
Thank you very much for these initial remarks on this very dire situation of the returnees. Questions in the room? Yes. Agence France-Presse. Go ahead.
Thank you. Could you say a little bit more about the conditions that those people who will be returning to the DR Congo, the conditions that they will be facing once they get there? And also, what is the outlook for those who decide to stay at this point? And finally, the flow of refugees, do you expect the flow that that you've witnessed recently to continue, or do you think it will start to tail off now? Thank you.
Ali? We can't hear you. We can see you, but we can't hear you. Don't know if you can...
You are here?
Yeah, no, it's fine. No, it's
you
fine.
Are here? You are... It's fine. Okay. As I say, refugees are returning in very fragile area given the recent conflict. So schools have been destroyed. Health facility also have been destroyed. The main road, whether from Goma to Uvira or from Burundi to Uvira, will remain closed. So we were not able to convey any assistance and co-relief item. Now we are negotiating. People are coming back, but we need to improve some living condition in area of return. That is why we are calling for additional support, and we are working also closely with partners, including government, to improve the condition of return. We recognize that at certain point, a certain area, it is difficult. But we start with the area which are secure for the time being. On the people who are going to remain in Burundi, definitely some of them will remain in Burundi, despite the fact that there is a shortfall in funding and assistance in Burundi. We hope that in the coming month, we will have sufficient support to help them remain in Burundi. It is the right to choose whether to come back home or to stay in a Burundi. So the question is in terms of flow. Yes, people are still coming back. I hope that your question is about people are coming back. People are still coming back. Earlier in April, we will sign a tripartite agreement between the government of DRC and Burundi and UNHCR. Currently, the return is take place spontaneously. So we are going to sign this peace agreement, tripartite agreement, and now to organize the movement. So we hope that the flow of return will increase in the framework of organized return. This is what I can say Babar is also around. I don't know if he has something to add, but this is what I can give as an answer. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Ali. Just in terms of putting things in perspective, remember when we alerted or briefed you in December broadly on the situation in terms of what was happening across South Kivu in December. So that had already displaced around 500,000 people internally. And then on the top, what you're hearing, there were cross-border movements that went into the neighboring countries. Nearly 240,000 Congolese had left to the neighboring countries, majority of them to Burundi then. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions to UNHCR online? Sure, go ahead, Emma.
For UNHCR, please. It's actually a question on what's happening on the Chad-Sudan border.
Let me see if there is any other question for Ali, because I don't want to make him wait. Satoko, is that for our colleague in Goma?
Yes, thank you very much for doing this. I just want to get the size of funding that you are asking for. How much do you need for internally displaced people in DRC, and how much do you need for supporting Congolese refugees in Burundi returning to DRC? Thank you.
Ali, please.
Okay. I will ask Baba, because some colleagues who are working on that, we are focusing more on the operation. So probably I will ask the colleague, Baba, or we'll come back to you on the exact figures that we have for the need, whether for IDPs in DRC, and also a refugee in Goma, in Burundi. Probably, maybe I can leave
sure.
this question to Baba.
Surely. Thank you very much. As just mentioned, in terms of DRC, our operations for UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, we need $145 million for this year, and that's, as being mentioned, is just above 30% funded. The exact percentage is 34% funded. For our operations in Burundi, our ask for this year is just above 100 million. And that, as far as I understand, is around 20% or under 20% for right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this. Satoko, you have a follow-up?
So basically, you are saying that you are not asking for additional funding.
Mohamed, for DRC, we already have for this year our funding levels, but those requirements needs to be met because we still have huge funding gaps in that response. So, in any situation, as refugees or people who are displaced, they return in big numbers, and there are additional requirements, we do go to our donors. But these are figures for now that we have, that we are sharing with you. In case anything is updated, then we'll share it further.
It's clear, yeah. We really need to complete the funding of these appeals. Okay, I don't see other questions. So, Emma, you have a question. Is that for UNHCR? Because we're going to listen from Tariq and from Marta on Sudan. It's up to you if you want to ask Babar.
Okay, Babar, since you're on the podium, if you don't mind. I was just hoping you could say a word about how the tensions between Chad and Sudan are impacting refugees. Some have been moved away from the border areas. So how are their lives impacted by this, and on what scale? And I was just wondering if you have anything on cholera preparations for refugees in that area, Chad, Sudan, South Sudan. I know that the season's coming up, and I also know that some other aid groups were concerned about getting supplies with the whole Middle East thing. Thanks.
I can check with colleagues and then get back to you. Thank you.
And as I said, we also have WHO on Sudan, so maybe they will also have an answer, at least for this country. So thank you very much, Babar. Thank you very much, Ali Mahamat, the UNHCR head of office in Goma, calling in from Goma. Thanks for being with us today. Good luck with your important work. And now let's stay in Africa. And as I said, go to Sudan. We've got Marta with me here on the podium to tell us about the civilian deaths in this country. And Tariq is also with us online. Tariq's brought us Dr. Hala Kudari, acting deputy WHO representative in Sudan, from Port Sudan. So maybe we start with our colleague in the field. Tariq, I don't know if you want to say something before I give the floor to Dr. Kudari, or we go directly to her. I see Dr. Kudari has connected. So if you want to go ahead, madam, and then I'll go to OHCHR and then open the floor to questions, please.
Hello. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for inviting me to this session. So this morning I will be briefing on the recent atrocious attack on the on healthcare in Al-Da'in in East Darfur. On the evening of the 20th of March, Al-Da'in Teaching Hospital was struck. Initial reports indicated 64 deaths and 89 injuries. Following search efforts, the number of deaths rose to 70, including 7 women and 13 children, as well as 1 doctor and 2 nurses. Injuries have also increased up to 146 people, including patients and their accompanying family members, in addition to 8 health workers. The hospital sustained severe damage, particularly to the outpatient and emergency departments. Images of the damage highlight the impact on patients, health workers, and community members who were present at the time. The hospital had already been damaged in a previous attack in August 2024. Since this latest attack, the hospital is no longer functional. WHO partners and health authorities immediately coordinated alternative facilities, mainly primary health facilities in Da'in, that now are operating around the clock. They're now taking patients who require emergency, pediatric, and obstetric services. Medical supplies that were sufficient for approximately 40,000 people had been pre-positioned in Da'in and now are being used to respond to this attack. Health facilities are being supported to expand services and absorb the increased demand. Additional trauma supplies are also being mobilized urgently from WHO's warehouse in Abéché, Chad, to also increase in the supply chain and make sure that the needs are attended to. Al-Da'in Hospital has served as a referral hospital for a population of over 2 million people for the Da'in city, as well as 9 localities in the East Darfur state. Patients may now, if the services are not available in Al-Da'in, they may have to travel over 160 kilometers to reach the next referral hospital, which, for patients requiring specialized services, which is a very difficult 4-hour trip, if not more. This significantly reduces access to essential services and essential healthcare in a region and country that is severely affected by the prolonged conflict since 2023. An attack on a hospital is not only an attack on a building. It's an attack on people seeking care, on health workers risking their lives to save others, and on the very possibility of survival at times of crisis. Sudan is approaching its 3rd year of armed conflict, but the attacks on healthcare continue. Health facilities, ambulances, health workers, and patients have been repeatedly targeted. Since the 15th of April in 2023, WHO has verified 213 attacks on healthcare, resulting in 2,042 deaths and 784 injuries. In 2025, Sudan accounted for 82% of all reported deaths on the attacks on healthcare system globally, which reports on attacks from 26 different countries and territories. In the first 3 months of 2026, 12 attacks have been verified, reporting over 180 deaths, which is double the deaths and four times the injuries reported in the first quarter of 2025. Access to care is shrinking, and efforts to repair or restore damaged facilities and equipment are being undermined. WHO closely works with health authorities, health partners to scale up services in affected areas, including Darfur. Despite ongoing conflict, access constraints, and limited funding. This includes support to service delivery through partners, deployment of medical teams, in addition to preventing and controlling outbreaks, strengthening immunization, and supporting medical supply chain. However, the health system remains under severe strain. Access is limited and funding shortfalls are constraining the response. The health response for 2026 is currently funded at barely 6%, limiting the ability to sustain services and deliver care. Stronger financial support is critical for the health emergency response. But above all, the violence must stop. WHO calls on all parties to the conflict to respect international health law, which prohibits attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure, including health care. Health services, health care workers, and patients must be protected. Increased diplomatic efforts are urgently needed to de-escalate the conflict and ensure the protection of civilians, health workers, and humanitarians. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kudari. And also on Sudan, we now hear from OHCHR.
Good morning, everyone. A sharp increase in the use of drones to conduct airstrikes this year in Sudan underlines the devastating impact of high-tech and relatively cheap weapons in populated areas. According to information received, over 500 civilians were killed in such strikes from the 1st of January to the 15th March. The vast majority of these civilians' deaths were documented in three states in the Kordofan region. In the first 2 weeks of March alone, information received shows that over 277 civilians were killed, over three quarters of whom were killed in drone strikes. Such deadly attacks have continued in the past week, as the holy month of Ramadan came to a close. In the deadliest attack on the 20th March, the first day of Eid al-Fitr, an air and drone strikes hit Al Dain Teaching Hospital in East Darfur State, killing at least 64 people, including 7 women and 13 children. One doctor was killed and 8 health workers were among the at least 89 injured in the attack in an area controlled by the Rapid Support Forces. The hospital, including its emergency, maternity, and pediatric units, are fully out of operation, further constrainingly, desperately needed access of men in the area to the right to health. On same day, in Adabad, in northern state, an area controlled by the Sudanese armed forces, drone attacks impacted civilian infrastructure, including an electricity substation and also an engineering college. 6 people were reportedly killed, and power completely cut to the locality. On the evening of the 21st March, further drone strikes on a convoy of commercial transportation vehicles in Al Dain reportedly killed 23 people, including women and children. In Al Dabat, further drone strikes appear to have been intercepted. Widening drone attacks are spiraling across Sudan borders, with serious risk of further escalation carrying regional consequences. There have been drone strikes on the town of Tina and Tine on the South Chad border after earlier ground offensives by the RSF. On 16 March, around 20 people were killed, including civilians, and 60 others injured during an RSF ground offensive on Tina, Sudan. And on 18 March, a drone attack hit Tine, Chad, killing at least 24 civilians and injuring around 70 others. Continued patterns of such attacks striking civilians and destroying civilian infrastructures raise serious concerns about compliance with international humanitarian law's fundamental principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution, and may amount to war crimes. The UN Human Rights Office continued to document attacks on markets, energy and water infrastructure, and health facilities. Healthcare facilities and health workers are specifically protected against attacks. We urge all states, particularly those with influence, to do all in their power to end arms transfers that are fueling the conflict and being used in manifest disregard of the obligation to protect civilians in conflict. We remind the parties to this conflict of their binding obligations to protect civilians. There needs to be renewed diplomatic efforts towards an urgent ceasefire to bring the conflict to an end. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And indeed, we join our colleagues in calling for an immediate end to attacks on civilians and civilian infrastructure, respect for international humanitarian law, the protection of health care and humanitarian personnel, a cessation of hostilities, and rapid, safe, and unhindered access for humanitarian goods and workers. And I'll open the floor to questions now. In the room, I saw Emma Reuters.
Yeah, thanks for the briefing. One for each of you, please. Just to clarify from the WHO, the 70 death toll, is that something you verified at this stage? And can you also confirm what OHCHR said about it being an aerial strike with drones? Is there any description of the strike? And would you be able to say, Marta, who is actually responsible for that attack on the hospital? Thank you.
Let me start with the doctor, please. Dr. Kudari, if you have an answer for Reuters.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for the question, Emma. With regards to the verification, indeed, our teams on the ground are working closely with the health authorities and partners in the State Ministry of Health, who actually also verify these numbers. That's why there was an increase after a couple days. There were search and rescue effects under the rubble, and an additional six were reported that or unfortunately lost their lives due to the attack. And this also applies to the injuries that were also increased. But indeed, we work with the partners on the ground, and the figures are also verified with the State Ministry of Health on the ground. As for the type of attack, usually under our mandate of the reporting on attacks on healthcare, we don't actually report on the type of artillery or weaponry used, or do we report on the perpetrators. We focus on reporting on the attack and the impact on the healthcare, as well as the health, and the patients and healthcare workers. Thank you, and over to my colleague.
Yes, thank you, Emma. No, we cannot say who, we have not identified who committed this attack, but as I said, both parties to the conflict use extensively the drones. We have identified the different areas and who controls those areas. But no, our call is for both parties to stop immediately using this type of weaponry. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, Efe?
Thank you. Alicia Agar from Spanish News Agency. I wanted to ask to Dr. Kudari if she could tell us how was the situation of healthcare in Sudan previous to the war and how it has changed, and if is Darfur is the most affected region by this type of attacks. Thank you.
Dr. Kudari.
Thank you for the question. Ideally, I mean, if we look at the change of the situation of health service and the health system in Sudan, of course, it has been impacted massively since the start of the crisis. It's difficult to pinpoint in one answer how much it's been affected, but indeed, at some point in time, we were reporting the functionality of health facilities had reduced by 50 or even 70% in some of the areas. So realistically, we can look at it from the sense of functionality of services where it is impacted. Our HERAMS reports that as of now, on the bigger scale of the country, approximately only 60% of facilities are partially or fully functioning. So this is, rather low. And of course, the functionality levels differ from one facility to another. When it comes to I do want to highlight that there is a lot of efforts that are being done by health partners, by, together closely with WHO and the Ministry of Health, where they're really trying to sustain and revitalize services where needed. Of course, these attacks undermine these efforts and in some cases, really affect facilities that were previously supported or even rehabilitated. And we lose a lot of the efforts that were put many, many years ago, not just in the last 2 years. When it comes to the second part of your question,
Darfur.
You mentioned health facilities and Darfur, yes, indeed. So the attacks on healthcare, we did recently see an increase in the Darfurs, but as well as in the Kordofans. But we also see and report on attacks in other parts of the country as well. So realistically, we do see increases in areas where conflict is raging, of course. And we report on the attacks mostly. We've mostly seen an increase in the Darfurs and the Kordofans in the late months. Thank you so much, and over to you.
Thank you very much. Other questions to? Oh yes, Robin, AFP, French News Agency.
Thank you. Just on the numbers of people killed and injured in the attack, could you go over those again? I think you said there were 146 now injured, but did that include the medical personnel? And then secondly, Marta, on the drones. Are you looking into where these drones are coming from? They must be being supplied from somewhere. And what can be said about how they're being used, what they're being used for? Are there any patterns emerging? Thank you.
Let's start with Dr. Kudari.
Thank you. Thank you very much. For the numbers, I can re-mention the numbers. We have reached the number of deaths reported rose to 70. This includes 7 women, 13 children, 1 doctor, and 2 nurses. And injuries went up to 146, including 8 health workers. Happy to repeat if needed.
Marta?
Yes, thank you, Robin. We don't have a specific information on who is supplying, but there's been investigations by the FFM on who is supplying weapons to the warring parties. There's an embargo on arms in Darfur in place that clearly is not being applied. We are calling to this arm embargo, and the High Commissioner has been saying it for a long time now, that a whole arms embargo across the country, because now we see not only big weaponry, but this type of drones, and we are not seeing, I cannot talk about it specifically, it's not our mandate, about the type of arms that we have, but we have seen that they are being used by both parties, they are all over the country, and they are having a devastating impact on civilians. And as I was saying in the briefing note, we've seen a spike, massively increase of these weaponries that are easily used and available. So again, we call for states and not using, and states that are providing this arm to stop filling arms to Sudan. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any other question in the room or online? No. So Marta, stay with us. I'd like to thank Dr. Kudari, unless Tariq wants to say something. No, I don't see his hand up. So thank you very much to WHO. Thanks, Dr. Kudari, for connecting with Geneva. And I like to now go to another continent. You have a briefing on Haiti. So let's hear this from OHCHR.
You might have received a press release that I'm going to read out. A new UN human rights report published on Tuesday details the human rights impacts of the expanding reach of guns in Haiti. According to data verified by our office, at least 5,519 people were killed in Haiti and 2,608 were injured between the 1st of March 2025 and the 15th January 2026. Violence perpetrated by gangs has resulted in at least 1,424 people killed. Operations against gangs led by security forces have caused at least 3,497 people to be killed. And attacks against gangs by self-defense groups have caused at least 598 people to be killed. Gangs have terrorized the population by killing and kidnapping people, trafficking children, stealing at illegal checkpoints, extorting money from businesses, and destroying and ransacking public and private properties. Gangs continue using sexual violence to spread fear among, subjugate, and punish the population. The report adds, detailing grave abuse on an appalling scale. Between the 1st March 2025 and the 31st December 2025, at least 1,571 women and girls were victims of sexual violence, mostly gang rape. Others, including children, were coerced into so-called sentimental relationships with gang members and were subjected to prolonged sexual exploitation and abuse. The report also documents instances of unnecessary or disproportionate use of force by police. Between the 1st March 2025 and the 15th January 2026, it identifies 247 instances of actual or attempted summary executions of suspected gang members or individuals believed to support gangs, resulting in the deaths of 196 people. Since March 2025, a private company, reportedly hired by the Haitian government, has taken part in security operations, including using drone strikes and helicopter gunfire. Some, or even most, of these drone strikes and helicopter operations could be described as targeted killings, given the apparent predetermined, intentional and deliberate use of lethal force against individuals specifically identified in advance. No investigation appears to have been opened by the judicial authorities to establish the legality of these operations and the circumstances in which the killings and injuries occurred. States are accountable for the actions of private military and security companies that they employ to perform security functions on their behalf. Such companies must comply with the same international human rights obligations as national police, and states are required to prevent, investigate, and address serious violations committed by them. The report also details violence perpetrated by self-defense groups and mobs engaging in so-called popular justice. Armed with stones, machetes, and increasingly high-caliber firearms, these groups have lynched individuals suspected of gang affiliation, as well as others deemed to have committed crimes. Some killings were allegedly encouraged, supported, or facilitated by police elements. High Commissioner Volker Türk stresses that it is essential for the authorities to provide security while following upholding human rights. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marta, for this for telling us about this report. Is there any question? Yes, Efe?
Thank you. Do you know what is the origin of this private company that has taken part in security operations? I don't know the country of origin or where this company comes from.
Yes, thank you. This company, you will find the name on the report, Global Vectus. It has ties to a mother company in the US. And as I said, it's been reportedly hired by the Asian government. But as the exercise functions equal to the police, they are obliged to comply with the certain norms, the norms and standards. That's why we are calling to the Asian government to comply their obligations of fully respecting human rights and prevent any action by this company that violates the rights of the population.
Any other question? Let me see if online we have any hand up. No. Oh yes, Robin. I keep not looking at you. Sorry.
On the situation in Haiti, does your office perceive that there is a lack of international action across the board on the situation in Haiti, and is that something that that your office finds troubling or alarming?
Thank you. As you may know, the gang suppression force has been adopted by the General Assembly. Countries are now organizing it. We are cooperating with the core organizers, providing providing support to the creation of the standards to be able to create an accountability program. It's very important. It's crucial for us that this suppression, this gang suppression force, is established within the framework of accountability. Program. That means that police or military involved in the actions act according to the law. And if there's any misbehavior, if there's violation, it's important that the authorities investigate and detain and the prosecution if it's necessary to avoid impunity, because one of the problems in Haiti, a long-standing problem, is the impunity and the lack of accountability. So there's steps being taken nationally and internationally. The fight against the gangs is crucial, but as the High Commissioner said, in the framework of human rights, of respecting and upholding human rights in all the actions, on all the security actions.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Let me see if there's any new one online. I don't see any. So, Marta, thank you very much for this update. And as she said, you've got the press release in your mailboxes. So that brings us to the end of the briefing. I have a few announcements for you, as usual. First of all, on the committees, the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, concluding next Thursday at 5 p.m., its 34th session. You have heard about the Human Rights Council, and we hope to announce soon the date of the next public plenary meeting of the Conference on Disarmament. There is, I wanted to also, sorry, let me take the paper. Here, I've been asked by UNOPS, our colleagues at UNOPS, to draw your attention to the press release that we've sent you. Press release, the statement issued by UNOPS yesterday on behalf of their executive director, Jorge Moreira da Silva. Mr. Da Silva is at the moment in London today and tomorrow for an official visit, including meetings with the UK government officials, Member of Parliament, think tanks, and media interactions. The statement he put out yesterday concerned the situation in the Middle East, and he said the escalation in the Middle East continues to have a devastating toll on civilians and livelihoods with global ripple effects. And you can see all the numbers, all the figures that he is giving you on this situation. He concludes by saying there is no military solution. The only way to end this mayhem and people suffering is through a diplomatic and peaceful solution and the implementation of all UN Security Council resolutions. There are a number of important international days. Today is World Tuberculosis Day, and it's also International Day for the Right to the Truth concerning gross humanitarian human rights violations and for the dignity of victims. And tomorrow, 25th of March, the International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade, and the International Day of Solidarity with Detained and Missing Staff Members. And you have received the statements of the Secretary General on both days. I also wanted to invite you to join us for the next screening of Cine ONU. We have a very special evening, quite exceptional, I have to say. The movie that will be screened is Muganga, Celui qui soigne. It's a compelling film depicting the life and work of Nobel Peace Prize laureate Denis Mukwege, the renowned doctor. He is very well known, as you know, for his tireless efforts in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, dedicating his life to treating survivors of sexual violence and advocating for human rights and dignity in conflict setting. This will be screened on the 26th of March, in 2 days, Thursday, at 6:45 p.m. at the Cinerama in town, the usual movie theater on the Rue de Carouge, and it will be followed by a video message from Dr. Mukwege himself, while the film's director, Marie-Hélène Roux, will also have a message. And then will be a panel discussion figuring the executive director of the Global Survivors Fund, which is the fund which has been created by the doctor. Then there will be also Professor Yasmin Abdul-Kadir. I think you know her. She's participating in many of our events. She's an obstetrician, gynecologist, specializing in sexual medicine in the Geneva University Hospital. Professor Guy Bernard Cadier, a surgeon and colleague of Dr. Mukwege at Panzi Hospital in DRC. And our colleague Sophia Kaltrop, director of UN Women Office in Geneva. They will all be there to talk about this important issue and about the work of Dr. Mukwege. And we hope to see you there. And I think I've told you everything I had. So if there are no questions for me, I don't see any hand up. Thank you very much, and I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.